You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with the Writer, where readers and writers meet.
And story is everything.
We're your hosts tonight, Jim and Bobby Bell.
We're so happy to have you with us. That was the Hot Texas Swing Band, always starting off our show with a bit of their original piece, Hot Texas. Jim, who is our special guest tonight?
Special guest tonight. Gretchen Sherrington.
And she's come back for a second visit. We're going to be talking about her newest memoir, The Butcher, The Embezzler, and The Fall Guy, a family memoir of scandal and greed in the meat industry. And I got to tell you, you open the first page and you will not be able to put it down.
Thank you. That's lovely.
Do you want to?
We have a little bio tonight. You know, our first, we interviewed Gretchen back in February, and we did her memoir, Parade of Justice, which is
license,
kind of a
license.
I always want to say poetic justice.
I have to make a note to myself.
Others have done that too.
Go ahead, Jim.
Okay. Gretchen is the daughter of Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Richard Eberhardt and grew up around literary icons from Robert Frost to Anne Sexton to James Dickey. Gretchen chose a long career in business, advising hundreds of CEOs on how to transform their companies into places where both business and people could thrive. Her first book, Poetic License, a memoir, was a 2021 Forward Indies finalist. Tonight's book, The Butcher, The Embezzler, and The Fall Guy, a family memoir of scandal and greed in the meatpacking industry, is Gretchen's latest title. Mm-hmm. Welcome, Gretchen.
Thank you so much for having me back. I have such fond memories of our first conversation.
Oh, it was so fun. Yeah. And I think this one will be more of the same.
You know, we've been talking before, I mean, now, and Bobby and I, you know, I don't know what it's like. Your father was a Pulitzer Prize winner. All his friends were Pulitzer Prize winners. Some of them won it more than once. I think there was even a couple of Nobel Prize winners in there.
I'm not sure of that, but anyway.
I wonder, what's it like to have Robert Frost come over and hang out? You know?
Yeah. I know. He had a big thatch of white hair, thick. You know, it's interesting because when I first met him, I think I was 5 years old, and my father had just started teaching at Dartmouth. And so Robert Frost had been connected with Dartmouth, and he would come over and for dinner just to sit in the living room with my dad. And I remember everybody felt like he was sort of a god. You know, that's how the family treated him. And he sort of seemed like that because he was white haired and he'd sit in the corner and everybody revered him. But my experience of him was that as a little kid, he just wasn't really interested. You know, he didn't want little kids around. We were in the way. So if my buddies were with me at the house and we were trying to get his attention or something, he just sort of didn't pay any attention to us. So I kind of thought of him as sort of grumpy, you know? So that was my first experience of Frost. But I will say that I actually liked his poetry because I think even as a child, I could understand it, or at least some of it. You know, it was fairly linear and straightforward, and there were rhymes. And so anyway, but he was we now have a chair at our summer cottage in Maine that he used to sit in And so people refer to it as the Robert Frost chair.
The Robert Frost chair. That's too funny.
That's great.
So tell us a little bit just more about yourself, about Gretchen.
Well, thank you for the quick bio. Let's see. I guess maybe one place to start is that I grew up really on college campuses. So during my first 5 years, we were living on five different college campuses, from the University of Washington to, I might not have these quite in the right order, University of Connecticut, Wheaton, Princeton, and then finally Dartmouth when I was five. And so my early life was really, you know, busy and moving all the time. And my father, you know, really looking for a job that would give him tenure, which he finally got at Dartmouth. And so, you know, the family was very social, very busy, people around all the time. It you know, even in my high school years, I don't remember more than a half dozen times when I just had dinner with my mom and dad. My brother by then was off at college. So it was a very busy social kind of family, very extroverted. Mm. And the swirl was really gathering around my dad. You know, that was very clear from the early days. Maybe that explains, and we stayed in Hanover. We thought we would stay there forever, so to speak. But my dad got asked to be the U.S. Poet Laureate under President Kennedy. And he'd already turned it down once. He didn't feel he could turn it down a second time. So my mother, somewhat, you know, upset at the time because she had made him promise that they'd be able to stay in the same place for 5 years. But how can you not say yes to that? And so, of course, we moved to Washington, D.C. for a couple of years. And we moved back to Hanover. Then I went away to school for 1 year. So I think that might be why I ended up spending 50 years in the same town in New Hampshire. I'd moved around quite a lot as a young person.
Yeah.
But now I've lived in New Hampshire for a long time, but 2 years ago we moved to Portland, Maine, where we are now. Yeah. And we love it. So we're happy where we are.
Your dad is the son of another amazing man. Yes. Who we meet in this book that we're talking about, The Butcher, the Embezzler, and the Fall Guy. Yes. And which of the three is he? Yes.
He is the Fall Guy.
He is the Fall Guy.
Yes.
When you were doing your research, because these are both memoirs,
yep.
and they're both very readable and very engrossing, some things dovetail between the two books. So were you doing research on one and then that led to the other, or how did that work?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think I was really working on trying to figure out who my dad was and, you know, my relationship with him. And that's what I was really doing research about in his literary archives at Dartmouth. And I found within that treasure trove four big cardboard boxes that he had kept of his father's letters. And it turned out that his father's letters were more or less during this period of time that was of interest to me because I'd grown up knowing about the story about George Hormel, who had recruited my grandfather to work for him to help him build his tiny little meatpacking company into a national brand. And I'd also heard about George Hormel, of course, from my father, and I'd heard about the embezzler, Ransom J. Thompson. Ransom Thompson, pretty good name for an embezzler.
Absolutely.
But he was called Cy for short. And so it was really in the context of doing the research for Poetic License that these materials showed up. And that just got me really invested and interested in trying to figure out what really happened to my grandfather, whether he was involved in the embezzlement or not. Of course, my family didn't think he was, and that's certainly what I heard growing up. And, you know, I got involved in writing Poetic License, and so this sort of sat for, I did some scene building and stuff from this book early on, but then kind of let it go for a while. And I thought it would appear in a short, truncated version in Poetic License, but when my publisher was working with me, she said, no, this is a separate book of its own, which I think was correct. And I'm glad she said that to me. You know, she said, this is your second book. So I had to then sort of refresh all the research I had done because I rewrote the whole thing in the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Could you elaborate a little bit on your business career?
Sure.
You know, we talked about it a little bit before, but you interviewed a lot of, you know, you made a lot of presentations, CEOs of big companies. Kind of what was that kind of about?
Yeah. Well, I didn't think it had anything to do with my father. I think at the time, I'm not even sure that it had, I thought that it had anything to do with my grandfather. But I will say that I, because of my experience growing up with all these famous writers, I was pretty intimidated by them on the one hand, and I was also turned off by the sort of big egos and the narcissism of many of the, you know, particularly big men writers of the of the 50s and 60s. And I wanted to kind of get away from that world. You know, it was not a draw for me. I'd always kept journals. I liked to write. I fashioned myself a bit as a writer, possibly. But it was very intimidating. As you pointed out, Jim, you know, I would look around the living room and everybody in the room had a Pulitzer Prize when I was 20, you know, so it was a National Book Award or, you know, or both. And so it was intimidating for me to even consider. That was the standard, in other words, for writing. So I really wanted to do something different. And when it came to me, this idea of consulting, which came after about 10 years of being in management, it turned out to be a path that I couldn't have imagined maybe I would have taken, but it came as a result of an incident in which is actually talked about a little bit, written about it in the book, where I was going through this merger, our organization was going through this merger, and it failed. And it was pretty traumatizing, professionally tough for me. And I just kept thinking there's got to be a better way to help organizations go through change than sort of annihilating everybody in the process. And so that got me thinking about, you know, trying to work inside companies to help CEOs, particularly, or their executive vice presidents or VPs, try to manage change in a different way. Mm-hmm. And what happened was that by some luck, and you know how those things are, some of the luck in our lives we make, maybe, and some of the luck just kind of falls on us. But in this case, you know, in terms of some luck, I ended up early in my career working with a few CEOs of banks and sort of mid-sized companies, mostly in New England at the time. And they took me in as if I was their confidant. Mm-hmm. I could remember the first time I really realized I had been meeting with a CEO for an hour or something. He'd heard about me from some other CEO, I guess. And anyway, he called me into his office. I was having a great conversation with him. And at the end of it, he said to me, "I've never talked about anything like this except for with my wife." And as I was leaving, flying away that afternoon, I thought, huh, that's interesting. I'd been told that as a woman, I wouldn't find a ground in management consulting. It was pretty much all men back then. But here was a guy, CEO of a company, who was confiding in me about things that were, you know, that he probably felt some vulnerability about and stuff, because he was having trouble with some members of his team. And he was trying to figure out why he couldn't get these two particularly aggressive men to work better together on the team. And he recognized that his leadership was not, you know, doing the right thing at that moment. He didn't really know what to do differently. So anyway, long story short, I recognized from that lesson that I might have a niche, and that, you know, men weren't going to compete with me. It was not, you know, what I learned was that a lot of them couldn't really talk to their bankers or their accountants or their lawyers about what was really they were fearing or what was really worrying them. But they could talk about those things with me. And so I ended up kind of developing a skill for providing, you know, creating sort of safe spaces for CEOs to actually open up about what their vulnerabilities were. And through that experience, I ended up having some really long-term relationships with CEOs and was just, you know, now that I've written and now that I've studied my dad and my grandfather, I can sort of look back and say, well, there was one thing about some of these men that really intrigued me, and that was that they were willing to take feedback on their behavior. And my father was incredible in many ways, but not all of his behavior was great. And he wasn't interested in taking feedback. And so I was intrigued by these powerful men who were willing. And so I just sort of kept working at it. In that kind of a world, I think, you know, if you do well with one CEO, they talk about you to somebody else. And pretty soon I was just, you know, that's kind of who I was attracting were CEOs who were really wanting to change their companies, but recognized they needed to change themselves too to make that happen. It was great.
It felt reading the book, and we knew a little bit about this, about your background. It felt like that was your background was really bringing some insights, and partly why it's a memoir, I'm guessing, because you're giving us the story. We're hearing it through letters and interviews and things that you conducted and such. But you're able to read between the lines, or you're able to be very mindful about other things that could be going on.
Yes.
I think from your experience, and I think that's another piece that makes this such a compelling read. Your grandfather had an enormous, all three of these gentlemen, the butcher, the embezzler, the small guy, amazing capacity for vision and for learning how to do it, but then delegate it or find the people to build the team or what, you know, that just, they took a tiny business and exploded it. What time are we at? We're having so much fun, Gretchen. Okay, so you know, this will be a good time to take our first little short break. And I know when you come back, we're going to do a little something about spam. And then you're going to read a passage for us. So stay tuned. Here is where you can find Gretchen's book. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shops Bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu. Choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer. Special guest, Gretchen Sherrington, and our book, The Butcher, the Embezzler, and the Fall Guy.
So one of the things that we did to get in the mood once we realized what we were writing about is we went to the grocery store and we got spam.
Oh, that's great.
Jim has the low sodium version.
And you have the regular version.
And I have one of many regular versions.
There are many flavors. Yes, exactly. You know,
this is really a fantastic product. It's been around a long time, and the company Hormel does a lot of business with this product.
That is true.
All over the world.
Yes.
How did this thing all get started, you know?
Yeah, it actually was invented in 1937. So this was actually quite a while after my grandfather had left the company. It was invented under the leadership of Jay Hormel, who was George Hormel's son, who had taken over. And I don't know how they came up with the formula, but the story goes that they needed a name for it and they couldn't figure out a name. And so they put out a contest and they said that, if you know, submit your names, what you think this product should be called. And you'll get $100, which probably in 1937 sounded not too bad. And so it turns out that the brother of one of my father's very best friends growing up in Austin, Minnesota, was the one who won that contest. He thought of it as spiced ham. So he sort of tied together SP and AM for Spam. And so he won $100, but I'll tell you, Spam's made a lot of money for them since.
That's for sure.
Oh my gosh. So let's go ahead and get more into the book now and the characters. And I think there was something you thought maybe you would read aloud for us to set.
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. And this is actually this is the very first chapter. And I thought it sort of sets the scene for these three men, for the actual story of what I was investigating, and for the place too, and the time that we're talking about. So it's just a couple of pages. One, Flimsy Pretext, Austin, Minnesota, 1922. In late January, 1922, Alpha Luru Eberhardt, my grandfather, peered out the multi-paned windows of George Hormel's executive office at the Red Cedar River below. The river was frozen stiff as death, splitting the meatpacking town in two. The afternoon temperature had barely risen since daybreak. A biting wind drove across the plains, blowing clouds of snow and factory steam eastward and rattling the window's glass. I imagine A.L., as my grandfather was called, stood his ground, undaunted, eyes sure, as he was forced to resign from the company he had spent 20 years helping to build. The men's words were brief that day. A.L. knew there was no point in arguing with his high-strung boss. George Albert Hormel was unlikely to change his mind. Maybe that day, as in photographs, George's right hand palmed his thigh, his fingers spreading south as if ordering a dog to sit. George's skin was paler than A.L.'s, his hair thicker and parted left to right, his nose nearly piercing his upper lip. His pinched eyes nipped the skin beneath his wire-rimmed glasses, conjuring a scolding teacher dressing down an errant student. When the ticking clock on his wall struck the next hour, packing house workers would hang up their aprons and head home. Despite the bespoke suits and starched shirt collars worn by these men, theirs was a killing business, an abattoir that turned plump animals into food, splattering blood on the meat cutters' aprons and dropping guts into buckets on the floor. The facts leading up to my paternal grandfather's forced resignation were clear. 6 months earlier, the company had discovered a nearly $1.2 million embezzlement by its star comptroller, Ransom Josiah Thompson. The defalcation, as it was called back then, had taken place over the course of nearly a decade. Newsprint across 1,300 cities had inked the story, with a New York Times headline reading, "Report shows embezzler got $1,187,000." After the embezzlement, the value of one share of Hormel stock plummeted almost to zero, scattering the company's assets and reputation to the wind, putting at risk 1,000 employees, and cratering my grandfather's personal wealth, much of it in Hormel stock. As A.L. watched Thompson being marshaled off to jail, town gossip swirled like eddies of pork fat, draining off the formal cutting floor. That January day, my grandfather trudged out to his Cadillac Suburban, hauling up the collar of his heavy Chicago-tailored wool top coat against the cold. Snowdrifts felt at his pant legs. Even the howling blow couldn't entirely conceal the sound of squealing pigs being prodded from outdoor pens onto the killing floor at the back of the factory. Across this Red Cedar River, A.L. pulled up the long, winding driveway to his estate. Snowfall blanketed the regal white peonies he and his wife, Lena Lowenstein, had planted 3 years earlier, which lit up the month of June each summer like puffy clouds dancing over the southern Minnesota plains. The couple's second son, 17-year-old Richard, who would become my father, was shoveling drifts from the family's front veranda. Inside their lavish home, Lena, 47 years old, lay dying. Whatever my grandfather said to his family about being fired that day, for it had been a resignation only in George Hormel's imagination, he he penned a letter to his closest friend and business confidant, George Hastings Swift, heir to the giant Chicago meatpacker Swift & Company. "You will probably be as much surprised as I was to know I have resigned my position, requested by Mr. Hormel on what seemed a very flimsy pretext." And so that's kind of lays out the basic.
It does. That's quite a passage. It does.
It's so descriptive, yeah. Gretchen. I feel the snow. I see the house. It's more descriptive than one could tell this story in a traditional nonfiction. Here's the story of the demise of, or this business rise and fall, or anything, because you bring this human element in, and the pigs are in the background, and right, you know, exactly. You really this whole book is full of these kinds of fabulous descriptions. You describe how AL sees Lena for the first time.
Yes. Yes.
Oh my goodness.
Yes. So let's see. My grandfather was born in 1867. George Hormel was born in 1860. My grandfather was born in 1867. And when he was about 20, he was the son of a minister, and he was working in a, he had run his own company as a sales, you know, he had a gentleman's clothing store really in Chicago. But the financial panic came along, and he was kind of had to sell the business or lost it. I'm not quite sure which. And so he was out sort of doing, you know, sales jobs and stuff. And he also worked at the State House in Illinois as well. And there was a guy who was a friend of his in a boarding house. And the guy said, "I'm going off to Whitehall, Illinois for the weekend, where my girlfriend," or whatever he called her, "is living. Why don't you come along? Maybe we'll find somebody for you." And so my grandfather took him up on the trip.
Okay.
And as they're driving down Main Street of Whitehall, Illinois, he catches the view of this, or the sight of this woman who was 7 years younger than him. So she was, I think he was probably about 25 then. She might have been 18 or 19. But, you know, she looked beautiful. She was dressed in a white dress. She was standing on the porch, leaning against the post. And she had very dark hair, lots of it. And he looked at his friend and he said, "That's the girl I'm going to marry." And he did about a year and a half later.
And she was singing. I think
she was singing. Yeah, she had a really beautiful voice.
Yeah. Oh, what a story.
Yeah. As I remember the book, he does ask her to marry him, but she's not going to marry him unless he gets a really good job. As I remember.
That is true. She put him off for quite a while. I think he really liked her spunk quite a bit. But her father had just died. She was grieving the loss of her father. And I think, you know, he represented probably moving away from Whitehall. And she was absolutely, they both were smitten with each other immediately. But I just don't think she was quite ready. And so she put him off for a while and did basically say to him that she didn't want him to just have any job. She wanted him to have a good job. And so anyway, that's how they started. So they moved to Chicago, and that's when he worked his way into George Swift's office at Swift Meatpackers. And because he needed a job. And I don't actually know the genesis of that meeting. I don't know if he knew the son, George Hastings Swift. Anyway, you know, they were friends or something. Mm-hmm. They were the same age. And whether that's why he burst into Gustavus Swift's office, or whether it was a big company in Chicago and they needed salesmen and et cetera. Anyway, the story is that he burst into the office and said, "I need a job."
You know,
he was given one.
Those salesmen are like that. You know? Yeah. You can understand. Yes.
He had charisma, for sure. Yeah.
I'd like to just ask a question about the meatpacking industry at that time. And I didn't pick it up from your book. You know, there were a number of books written about what a nasty, nasty business it was back then.
Yes.
But I didn't get the feeling that was quite the story with Hormel, though.
And we need to say it right. Is it it's Hormel.
It's
Hormel. Hormel. Okay, yes. Hormel.
Yes. Uh-huh. Although most of us know it as Hormel.
But it's Hormel.
As I understand from everybody in Austin, the family pronounces it Hormel.
We want to get it right.
So, I mean, meatpacking is a tough business. It is still, you know, it's, you think about what they're doing. They're taking live animals and cutting them up into pieces. And so I think it's probably still a pretty rough business in a lot of ways. But back then it was much smaller, of course. And of course, George Hormel, as the founder and owner, would have known everyone. So they were real people to him, and he was a real person to them. He was known as a tough boss, but I think there was respect for him and admiration, certainly, for his starting this company. And back then, of course, the meat was all, the animals were purchased from local farmers and, you know, brokers. So much more like you might buy meat today from a small farm near your home or something, rather than now where you go into the grocery store and everything's packaged in plastic and it's been shipped across the country. And I think the companies were a little bit different, but certainly the Chicago meat packing companies were pretty rough. And George Hormel had had a view of that because he worked for his uncle, Jacob Decker, who for a little while after he left home. And he and Jacob Decker had a small meatpacking company in Chicago. So he got to see the Chicago stockyards up close. He was pretty reviled, it seems like, from his autobiography by them. And he wanted to do something different. So from the very early days, he got known as somebody who kept very clean factory, relatively speaking, you know, very clean factories. And cared a lot about the people. You know, he paid them well, generally more than average wages. Again, this was in the early days. So I think overall, you know, he was a terrific entrepreneur with great vision, as you said, Bobby. I mean, if you imagine it, Southern Minnesota is not where you would think you would put a meatpacking company. It would be near Chicago at that time. But he had a vision. You know, he thought that he could go up against the big guys, but he needed sales leadership to do that. And that's how my grandfather enters the story, because he was recruited by George Hormel in 1901 to come work for him to provide sales leadership. Before AL arrived, George Hormel's brothers, three of them, had been riding around on bicycles around the countryside selling meat.
That's good.
Well, that wasn't going to take him to a national brand. So he recruited my grandfather. I have the letter of acceptance of the job by my grandfather. It was one of the things I found in the boxes at my father's archives. And so he moved himself and Lena, obviously, to Austin in 1901.
Mm-hmm. There were a lot of innovations and things going on at this time that I found fascinating. Refrigerated cars, I mean, all kinds of things, new cuts of meat, not being wasteful, understanding that you want to use every single, you know, bit
that you can.
And these were all just visionary things that had a huge impact on business overall, the economy, thousands of people working, all the number of hogs or pigs that were raised and used every year was in a day mind blowing to me. How in the world did
I know. It's incredible. And you're really right. And I think, you know, initially, I think Gustavus Swift of Swift and Company was really quite a entrepreneur himself and also a business leader in terms of some of those innovations. The refrigerated rail car really was perfected by him. And my grandfather, working for Swift, understood the refrigerated rail cars and how to exploit them to make, you know, to get product to different markets. And so I think that's probably one of the reasons he was of interest to George Hormel, was because he kind of understood that. And that's where Hormel wanted to go too, because Minnesota actually had a very early and effective and good rail grid across the state. So you could kind of get anywhere. And certainly once you got to Minneapolis, you could get to Chicago or, and then Boston, New York, et cetera. So I think, you know, the combination of AL's expertise and Minnesota's rail grid and George Hormel's ability to finally get a license to, he had to get certified, or I can't remember what the term was, but he had to get approved to be able to use the refrigerated rail cars. And, so yeah, but the cuts of meat, the other interesting story about Hormel is that, when he was working with his for his uncle, Jacob Decker, in Chicago, Decker said to him, I can't remember exactly the quote, but something like, you know, clean meat doesn't spoil. Dirty meat spoils. So the lesson that Hormel learned from that was cleanliness was important. And he took that with him when he started building his company. It was his father, really, who was a tanner in Toledo, who instilled the idea of innovate, don't imitate. So his father actually set him on that course of innovation. And I think to this day, I can't really speak to the current Hormel Foods at all. But I think to this day, it's known as an innovative company. They're constantly rebranding or, you know, and buying new brands and changing things up. So that's kind of baked into the DNA of the company now.
So interesting. We're going to take another break, Gretchen. And when we come back, we want to talk a little bit about process of memoir writing and maybe some things you learned about your family. No spoiler alerts that were surprises as you went along. We'll be right back.
Yeah.
Here at the Out West Shop, we're passionate about the American West, the truth and the myth. We're purveyors of fine Western goods. We scout for unique and distinctive apparel, accessories, home decor, and general merchandise that are a reflection of the Western lifestyle. We hunt for unique artisans and craftsmen who are inspired to create decorative art you can wear based on their own love for the story of the West. We round it up and bring it to you. Check out OutWestShop.com when you need anything Western.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer. Special guest, Russell Sherrington. And we're talking about the Butcher, the Embezzler, and the Fall Guy. That's a long title.
Plus, there's a long subtitle.
Yes, a family memoir of scandal and greed in the meat industry.
You know, Gretchen, we know you did a lot of research here for the book, and obviously the one before, but did you invite other family members with you to help you in this?
Yes, I recruited all my cousins. I have several cousins have died, unfortunately, but I do have wonderful, wonderful Eberhard cousins, and every one of them gave me something for the book. One of them, Eloise, came with me on one of my trips to Austin, one of my research trips, and she has stood by me from the very beginning on this book. She certainly felt that AL was wronged by George Hormel, and I think on some level she still feels that, but she also was very interested in learning, you know, what I was finding, along with her sister Lil, and so my cousins have been really helpful through this whole thing, and it's been a delight for me to help this story be told more broadly. I think even if they don't agree with every word I wrote or would have said something differently, I think they're really grateful to have a document that sort of lays out the story, certainly in my own way, but that they also feel is valid. And that was important to me too.
you attended, I think, with your brother, a very important, and it had long, has had long impact on your life, to a school, well, to a school, a district, I think, mm-hmm. and students that were involved in a poetry contest. And you write about it. The story kind of comes in and out of the book. We sort of visit that moment. You want to talk, because it's a wonderful story. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So in, I think it was 2000, the city of, well, the school system of Austin, every year they put on a alumni event of some kind that sort of honors one of their alums in the high school. And so in that year, they wanted to, they nominated my dad to be, you know, the honorable person at this event. And it was good. It was constructed as a 3-day celebration citywide. This is a city of about 20,000 at the time. And I mean, when I saw the agenda, I was just amazed because it was just packed with appointments. My dad was then 96 years old and just was not up for the trip. And so he looked at me when I was talking to him about it and whether he wanted to go or not. And he said, why don't you go? And so then I said, well, maybe Dickon, my brother, would like to go with me. So we went out and we were just floored by this all city celebration of our father. It was really well done. It was exciting and super fun, a lot of it. It was hard emotionally, too, because I was struggling at the time with my relationship with my dad. And so there were, you know, it was hard at times. But overall, it was just, I still remember it with great fondness. But this one day, we were requested, they had set up a poetry prize. And every child from kindergarten through high school was required to write at least one poem. They were required to read my father's poetry. And first of all, I mean, what school dress does that, all 5,000 kids from K through 12. It was pretty impressive. So we were invited to go to the classrooms to see the children and to hear who had won for each class, you know, the poetry prize. So anyway, we were sitting in this one class that I'll never forget with a wonderful teacher, Carrie Bain, and she had worked with these students to study some of my father's most difficult poetry. And we were sitting on these little chairs in front of them. I think it was fifth graders. And they just started asking us these most beautiful questions from everything from how many pencils did your father use to, you know, what did your mother make for dinner, to then discussing his probably most famous poem, The Groundhog, in quite a lot of detail. And insight about the poem. I was just floored by them. I was so impressed. And one little girl asked me a difficult question at the end of the class, which was, do you like your father? And I had to come up with something at the moment. And so I kind of stumbled my way through the answer to that question. But it was one thing that sort of motivated me to keep going with poetic license. I wanted to be able to answer that question honestly. Anyway, I have tremendous admiration and respect for the Austin school system. And after this, my brother and I chose to set up an annual poetry contest, which continues to today. So every spring, I get a sheaf of poems from them. It's great.
That's just so wonderful. You know, we each never know the impact that our life might have, or something we do, or something we start. And then to reap it, to know it's happening, that's such a blessing. I'm looking at that nasty clock, Gretchen, and I don't like it. It's just ticking away. Where can people that listening or watching get your book and follow where you might be doing appearances? Where do they go?
Okay. Well, first, I think they can probably get it through your shop, right? Uh-huh. But they can get it wherever books are sold. If they want to learn more, they can go to www.gretchencharrington.com. The name is spelled correctly on the screen, one R in Charrington.
Yeah.
And they will learn other things too.
And I'm holding up both books because, oh, One of them. Oh, yeah. Oh, that's I'm good. Holding up both books. And we did talk with Gretchen back in, what was it, February? And you can find that podcast at LA Talk Radio on our Rendezvous page. And, of course, this is the book that we've been talking about tonight. Jim, you have a quote.
A quote?
Yes. Jim always picks such a good quote.
Actually, this is a passage from the book.
Great.
You know, we cling to our myths, especially heady and intoxicated ones. We want to believe them as truth. We help in their construction by denying what's in front of us and filling in holes to reinforce their validity. In very great myths, there are heroes, ones we don't want to see fail. We want our town, our company, our marriage, our family to rise and success, no matter what it looks like behind the veil. And C. Thompson created these myths, weaving himself into southern Minnesota's psyche like a boll weevil through a crop of cotton. By the time he was found out, it was nearly too late.
What a phrase. Like a boll weevil. What was that? Like a boll
weevil through a crop of cotton.
The text.
That's great,
prose,
isn't it?
The prose is full of those readers out there. You really will want to read this book. Gretchen, we're going to just take a moment. Thank you for being with us.
Total enjoyment.
Yeah. And do you have a third book in the works?
I do. Just starting.
Oh, good. So we know we're going to get to have you on again.
I'd love to be back. No date yet.
No, okay.
What's the book going to be about? Can you say?
Well, it's another true crime story, but it'll be fiction this time.
Okay.
But it's still right about up complicated families.
Yeah. Ooh, right
Very
up
good.
Our alley.
Oh, yeah. We'll like this.
Jim and I have a couple commitments coming up, so we are kind of rebroadcasting the next 3 weeks. One of those weeks is Thanksgiving. Best of Rendezvous next week will be rebroadcasting Manuel Schneider's book, The Cult of Destiny. And she just has won a number of awards very recently. And it's a fabulous interview. The following week, the team of Andrews and Wilson, they were with us in June, and we discussed their brand new book at that time, Dempsey, and wonderful team. You'll enjoy listening to them chat together. Thanksgiving night, we decided a good one is it's Murder, Don't You Know? Minnesota is its location, a quirky murder mystery with recipes by Jean Cooney. She was with us at the end of August, and it's all about the hot dish, which was not a term that, well, I learned a new
we call it a casserole.
Hot dish, yes, but you don't want to, yeah.
It's called hot dish.
And then we are back live with Chris Mullen, who we met at the Western Writers of America conference this summer, and we'll be talking about his book, Rowdy, Wild and Mean, Sharp and Keen.
Wow.
Hard to believe this is early November and the month is just going to fly by. So, Gretchen, thank you so very much for being with us again. We hope that you enjoyed this visit with us as well.
Totally. I always do. You're great.
And
thank you so much for
the listening audience, these are great books. And the one we read is a great book on management, a great book on business. And with a lot of twists and turns and... Do we get the embezzler or don't we?
And Christmas,
thank you so much.
Christmas is around the corner. Everybody should have at least one book wrapped for the holiday season. So thank you so much on behalf of Jim and me.
It's always a great day out west.
We'll see you down the trail.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank
Good night.
Thank you very much.